Imagine having to pay a landscaper for doing work, and you have money on Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal, all of which you don't fully trust. However, you keep a small balance on each of them just in case you need to spend between friends or with certain vendors. The landscaping bill is a bit heftier than it typically is, so instead of sending funds from Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal to your bank account to then pay the landscaper instead, you combine part of the balance from each application to pay the singular invoice the landscaper has provided you. That is essentially what has just been launched on the Cashew protocol. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving into a great little read. We're back with Marty's Bent by Marty Bent. And he just had a great, like, really short little rip on something that was super relevant to just the last episode we had with Alan Farrington's piece. And I just really kind of wanted to do a bit of a dive and rant on eCash, and this presented me with the opportunity. I was looking through my read selections, and this one like really stood out, and I just really liked it. It's kind of a cap on a lot of the things we talked about in the previous episode. Real fast, this show is brought to you by the HRF, the Human Rights Foundation, and their amazing financial freedom report, plus their development fund. If you have like a really fascinating project, Cashew being a great example, and you are trying to build freedom tools and make Bitcoin and Lightning and eCash and all of these things accessible, I highly encourage you to reach out and, of course, subscribe to their newsletter. The link will be in the details for both of those. They're such an amazing resource for the fight and to stay informed on the fight for human rights. Oh, and also for next year's Oslo Freedom Forum. Definitely check. That is the big event that they put on, and it's amazing. I've been there once, and I really want to go back again. So don't forget to check that out, too. And then lastly, PubKey. So what if you could go back and redesign the internet in a very web-friendly architecture, but you knew Web 2 was going to happen, and you wanted to make sure that it wouldn't? That you actually importantly decentralized the very things that led to that consolidation. That is PubKey. And because I can't possibly explain it in like 15 seconds, I'm just going to link to it so you can go check it out. I've been using it for a while during the beta, and I just want you to experience the feeling of signing into the PubKey app with your PubKey ring. Just get that far and then follow me on PubKey. I'll have link and details in the show notes. All right. So we're going to talk about eCash today, and I also just want to, I go off in the rant to follow, which is really long. A lot of them have been pretty long recently, but I really kind of go off on trying to paint a picture of how I think the market is going to evolve and what it really means, what the power of permissionlessness of the base layer of the network itself of Bitcoin and Lightning, how powerful that actually is, and why we really kind of miss how brilliant of a foundation we really have to find all of these solutions, and how we bring the market back to explicit trust and break down a lot of those limitations of where you aren't using a network because you trust it, but you're using it because everyone is on that network and everybody kind of collectively hates it, but you have to use it because that's where everybody is. With Bitcoin and Lightning being the foundation that avoids control of the network and allows instant settlement between, like, you're no longer trapped in a walled garden of, if you have this eCash, you can only spend it with people who have just this eCash. So you can have a true market of trust because you're not limited to using the same service or app or mint as somebody else in order to pay that person in their app and their mint. And this is all going to make, this should make a lot more sense after the read. So without going into a long rant that literally doesn't even have any context yet, let's go ahead and get into today's read. And it's titled, Pay attention. The cypherpunk banking stack is coming. From Marty's Bent, written by Marty Bent. The future banking stack is being built out in the midst of all the chaos. Quote, "My God, this blows my mind. Paid 100,000 sats invoice from two different cashew mints at the same time. Each contributed 50,000 sats. This is going to be a major game changer for cashew wallet user experience. Let me explain multi-nut payments." Cali BTC, May 5th, 2025. Tweets from Cali BTC. All cashew wallets let you use multiple mints. To reduce rug risk, we encourage users to leave only small amounts on each mint. This introduces a big user experience challenge, which forces users to distribute funds on different mints in a smart way. It's particularly problematic when you're trying to pay a bigger Lightning invoice from your small balances. If no individual balance can cover the invoice, you're forced to shift funds around multiple mints, etc. Who has time for that? The Lightning protocol allows nodes to split a single payment HTLC into multiple parts to increase the chance of reaching the destination, called multi-path payments. Typically, that's done with one sender to one receiver. What if you can just break the rules? A multi-nut payment originates from multiple Lightning nodes to pay a single invoice atomically. Even if none of your mint balances can cover an invoice, as long as your total balance is large enough, you can pay the invoice. End thread. While many are currently wrapped up in press releases from public companies announcing that they've added to their Bitcoin treasuries, flame wars over op return limits, or more general geopolitical developments, cypherpunks are writing code. While the masses, many in Bitcoin included, are enthralled in day-to-day clickbait banter, there are serious builders building serious things at the moment. One of those builders is our friend Cali, who, alongside other open-source contributors, is building out the Cashew protocol, which enables individuals to leverage Chalmian eCash on top of Bitcoin. Earlier today, he demoed a pretty notable breakthrough for the Cashew protocol, a multi-nut payment, which enables users to pay a Lightning invoice by combining balances held in two separate Chalmian mints. For those of you who are unaware or need a refresher on Chalmian mints, they enable an individual to lock up a certain amount of Bitcoin in a mint and receive a commensurate amount of eCash tokens in return. Chalmian mints leverage a blinded signature scheme to ensure that individual users have privacy while they're spending their eCash tokens. Users lock up Bitcoin in a mint. The mint issues tokens of different denominations to those users, and after the user receives their tokens, the mint has no idea which individual user is spending which eCash tokens within the mint. This increases the privacy of individual users on top of the privacy benefits. Spending with eCash comes with instant settlement, very low fees, and is interoperable with other second-layer solutions like the Lightning Network. When users decide to engage with Chalmian mints, they are making a trade-off. They are trusting the individual mint operators not to steal their funds or debase the eCash tokens within their mints for the ability to transact privately, cheaply, and across multiple different interoperable protocols. While this is certainly a trade-off that no one should take lightly, I think it is important to understand that these Chalmian mint protocols like Cashew are permissionless, which means that anyone can leverage the open source code these protocols are built on to spin up their own mints, enter the competition for Bitcoin banking services, and serve end users. Due to the very low barrier to entry that exists among these mint protocols like Cashew, I don't think it's crazy to say that competition can be a forcing function for mint operators to act in the best interest of their end users. I strongly believe that Chalmian mints are going to be a vital part of scaling Bitcoin to billions of users over the coming decades. And this feature that Cali demoed earlier today is going to be a very crucial component of that scaling process. Enabling individual users to distribute risk across many mints is going to be crucial to create the competitive landscape necessary for an incentive framework from which mint operators are pressured by the market to provide reliable and valuable services. Unlocking the ability to combine balances from multiple mints to pay a single invoice is an incredible step in that direction. Imagine having to pay a landscaper for doing work and you have money on Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal, all of which you don't fully trust. However, you keep a small balance on each of them just in case you need to spend between friends or with certain vendors. The landscaping bill is a bit heftier than it typically is, so instead of sending funds from Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal to your bank account and then pay the landscaper instead, you combine part of the balance from each application to pay the singular invoice the landscaper has provided you. That is essentially what has just been launched on the Cashew protocol. This is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm extremely excited to see the continued development of all Chalmian Mint protocols and the use cases they enable. The Achilles heel of these protocols up to this point is the fact that users are incentivized to concentrate risk with individual mint operators to solve payment UX problems. Multi-nut payments alleviate that risk and intensifies the forcing function of competitive market dynamics that should lead to better end products for users of these protocols. I've said it many times, but I'll say it again. There are many discussions being had about how to scale Bitcoin at the protocol layer. I think it is unwise to depend on changes to the protocol layer to scale Bitcoin. We have many tools at our fingertips to scale Bitcoin to billions today that come with certain trade-offs that have not been tested. Multi-nut payments are a great example of ways to scale Bitcoin with the tools that are at our fingertips right now. Most are completely missing it, but the cypherpunk future is being built out right before our eyes. Number go up and semantic dick measuring contests can certainly draw a lot of attention, but I implore you to rise above the noise and follow projects like this, which are actually solving massive user experience pain points in real time with things that can be used today. Pensions facing a second lost decade without Bitcoin adoption. Dom Bay, a firefighter running for CalPERS Board of Trustees, delivered a compelling warning during our recent conversation. He pointed out that CalPERS outgoing chief investment officer described missing the private equity boom as their, quote, lost decade. Bay argues that pension funds nationwide are setting themselves up for another missed opportunity by ignoring Bitcoin, leaving them perpetually underfunded while seeking increasingly risky traditional investments. Quote, you're going to have similar commentary from pensions around the country in 2035 saying, hey, we're going to get into Bitcoin now. We had a lost decade where it was just staring us right in the face and we didn't really need to do much but learn about it, and we missed the boat. Dom Bay. I've long maintained that institutional adoption of Bitcoin is inevitable, but timing matters tremendously for returns. With CalPERS sitting at just 75% funded and facing high CIO turnover, Bay's approach of education and incremental adoption offers a practical path forward. The volatility fears that keep pensions away from Bitcoin can only be addressed through proper education, something severely lacking in these massive financial institutions managing trillions in retirement funds. Check out the full podcast here for more on Bitcoin's role in energy transitions, the politics of CalPERS governance, and how unions are adopting Bitcoin on their balance sheets. Final thought. I've come around on Gen Z. I'm pretty bullish. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. Always a fan of Marty's Bent. I would highly recommend it, and I'll put a link down in the show notes. Again, it's one of the few newsletters that I keep up with. I think I have like maybe 10 or 15 that I really like to keep up with. Like Financial Freedom Report being one of them by HRF. Also, he actually wrapped it up. I skipped this part just because it was just kind of like a little list. It mentions the Bitcoin Policy Summit that is literally happening today and some recent headlines, and also mentioning and kind of giving a breakdown for 1031, their fund. So I'll have the link so you can go check that out if you're interested. But this one really caught my attention because I think it really is, you know, the signal of what's happening in the space and what's being built is always at the edge. And it's amazing how much You know, I it's crazy to me that people are like pessimistic or like, oh, it's all captured now or whatever, because they're focused entirely on Bitcoin treasury companies or BlackRock making an ETF and failing to realize that the biggest portion of it is always going to be the quote unquote normalization of the last era of maturation, of the growth phase of this thing. You know, it's like focusing today entirely on Twitter and Facebook when it comes to the internet rather than Bitcoin and Nostr. Like, in my mind, it only makes sense that kind of the last era of what was the bleeding edge of solving the problems of the era before is going to be normalized. Like, it's going to scale up to the point that whatever problem that is specifically solving, and when we're looking at Bitcoin, the base layer, it's solving the largest problem. And the largest problem is not retail payments. The largest problem is the trust and independence of a global monetary system, of a global monetary asset that isn't controlled by one political entity or subject to any small or large group of political entities. It is solving the trust layer, and it is going to scale up at doing that. And what we need more than anything is that trustless global foundational layer for the monetary good and monetary access. And I just think the permissionless nature is one of the least, like, people don't talk that up enough. People don't understand how important that is in the context of, like, everybody's so focused on retail payments network. Can Bitcoin be a good retail payment network? How do we make it a better retail payment network? And have lost the understanding of why it is that gold failed, because it wasn't at retail that we lost the gold standard. It was not, like, the retail layer is the thinnest layer at the edge of where the bulk of the problem of mispricing the world's capital and the inability to actually secure prices in massive capital markets against the limitation, the actual scarcity of real resources on the ground. Gold failed at that way before we were sending transactions on the internet, and it happened way before it wasn't at the going to the store and paying somebody your money. That was not the level where gold failed. And the massive centralization in so many of the problems that we have with surveillance, with trust, with limits on, like, what we can even have as, like, an authored service, like, how difficult it is, even with fintech, the fact that there is so little variety, there is so little real opportunity to actually be different from the other service that you use or from the other bank. Have you ever actually looked into what it takes to make a bank? I actually did this a few years ago out of just sheer curiosity. And there's something, like, to even get on the table for asking a permission from the, like, understand, you have to ask permission. You can't just make a bank. You have to be plugged in to somebody else's network that they own. It's like asking for an API from Twitter, except that it's an API from fiat, from a Federal Reserve. You have to get an account with them, and to start one, just to get on the table and get the ball rolling, you have to have, like, a multi-million dollar bond as, like, this like proof of I'm doing this. So it's immediately, like, limited to such a huge degree. And just think about the technical hurdles, the forms you have to fill out, the number of different layers of people that you have to ask permission for, the card issuer permission and programs that you have to do, which are all the same. It's a big giant cookie cutter. That's why everybody ends up charging the same fees. That's why all the systems and the fintech tools all end up being the same. And they try to compete on the edges with these, like, little things that barely really make a difference. And really, they're just kind of trying to be the cooler brand with Venmo and PayPal and Cash App. And of course, they don't talk, they don't interoperate with each other. I can't send something from Cash App to PayPal. They still have all the same limitations. They still own the back end. It's like everything kind of works. It seems like it works really fast when you're in the sub $1,000 range. But as soon as you're sending $2,000 or $3,000, everything sucks again. It's all right back to fiat because you actually have to use the real fiat rails. You can't use this little like silly layer on top that's actually built into the app and it's actually just Cash App's internal spreadsheet that you're moving transactions between. And then they got to like double KYC you. And then there's this huge risk because nobody's actually holding keys. You're just an account with some central party who's actually just subservient and dealing with account, their own account that you're just a sub account of for two other major central parties that are all like monitoring and watching everybody's transactions. And you have to KYC up the ladder. Like the whole thing is an insane structure of control and permissions. And of course, you're only sending debt back and forth. It's all based on credit. You're still just reliant on every other entity in the system to have fulfilled payments. And you're all, everybody's paying fees everywhere. And they basically, because this is a closed network, because they can require permission, they basically charge the fee. They can basically just kind of like run the gambit. As long as they don't charge a fee so bad that somebody's going to put up $30 billion or maybe more to build a completely alternative infrastructure and onboard 100 million customers, which nobody's going to do because the network effect here is just ungodly. Like, it's incredible because it's a permissioned network. Like, you can't even get in the door. It's other people that you are reliant on to actually do anything. You can't do anything yourself. You can't just, like, build a thing. You can't just make a bank. Like right now, I could go down to my shop and I could just build something, right? I could sit here on my computer and I could just build an app and then somebody else could use it. I can do that because the technology of cutting things is permissionless. I can do that because the internet and my computer and all of the programming, the code, is permissionless. Like, I don't have to request an API to make use of the Python language to then build a simple script to make something in my workflow. This is the reason we have all of these tools. This is the reason we have a million apps. And you notice where all of our problems exist, where everything is like, oh, we need to fix this and we need to find a new solution for this, is where we end up back in a permission system. It's where we have to use the Apple App Store to get on the iOS devices. It's where we have to ask government permission in order to provide a monetary service or to provide a app service to somebody else where you can send payments. It's when Twitter could have added tips 20 years ago, but they couldn't because of a regulatory problem, because they would have been choked out of existence and it would have been an unbelievable nightmare with worse KYC than they already have, which now they have to do because of the horrible bots and AI stuff. Permissionlessness is everything. It is everything. It's one of the, it is tied into like that trifecta of those core things that if you lose them, you basically lose the other things. Even if you didn't directly lose them, you know, like privacy and assurances of the asset, all of that good stuff, right? Like, these core attributes of the system are interdependent. They're not actually individual attributes. They're dependent on the other things to actually exist in the first place. So it must be decentralized, and permissionlessness is just a nature of decentralization. But I want to try to paint the picture of how powerful that is. Go back to the idea of me trying to start a bank. And I don't mean from the waiting 2 years for permission for, I mean, look at, what was it? What's Caitlin Long's bank? The one that they've been trying to get, that's literally just a fully reserved bank. Like, the system that they have set up and they're trying to get permission for is hilarious because it would basically be the most secure bank in the Custodia. It would be the most sound bank in the entire banking system. And that's actually why they can't get permission, which is crazy, is that you have to leverage up just like everybody else. It's a little bit like the bailouts back in 2009, is they actually forced, like, BB&T didn't even want the loans. They did not want the bailout. But they were forced to take it, and they were threatened if they didn't take it because of what a disaster it would be if it showed or if they were allowed to demonstrate that certain banks were responsible and other banks were entirely, just committed fraud. It had to be that the entire system was dying and they had to save it. It couldn't be that there were crooks and that you actually could have been fine if you weren't a crook. But just think about it. Ignore the whole, do they even give you permission and how long do you have to wait to get permission? But just from a technical standpoint, what all do you have to have in place to have a bank that works? How many other entities are you dependent on? How many accounts do you have to have at how many different places? And what's the process of vetting and setup and forms and, you know, structuring of compliance and giving, and what data do you have to share? What do you have to plug into from all of these different ways to actually technically to just get something up that works as a bank with a card and where people can send you money in an account and you can provide them relevant banking services tied to a bunch of different fiat institutions and, you know, custodial offerings? Like, that doesn't even, like, I don't even want to think too hard about how horrible that experience probably is. Now think about how difficult technically it would be for me to set up an eCash Mint. I mean, just I bet I could have one up in probably 20 minutes. I mean, I haven't even looked at it. I haven't done it, but I bet I could have one that even works with the Nostr wallets that support eCash. Under an hour easily. Like, I could just pause the podcast and I could be like, let me set up an eCash Mint really quick. And then I could come back to the podcast and I could still finish the episode for the day. And guess what else? I don't have to email anybody. I don't have to ask permission. I don't have to fill out a form. And understand, I'm not saying that the regulatory environment suggests that I can legally do this and that there's no problem and that I'm not supposed to KYC my customer or anything like that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about from a technical point of, do I want it to exist? Like, if I didn't know, like, if I was just in some sort of a bubble and I just thought that, right, from a regulatory standpoint, that there wasn't even anything to be concerned or to consider, and I just wanted to offer and make a mint and then offer it to someone else on Nostr or with, you know, whatever wallet that they're using. Like, I would never reach a point where somebody was like, you can't connect to the internet because you haven't set up this compliance structure that feeds us this particular data and, you know, prove somebody's identity. Like, there would just never be, that barrier would never exist. Like, I would just end up running the eCash Mint and then somebody would, you know, if I did it publicly, somebody would just, you know, a couple of months, if it was even slightly successful, I'd get an email saying cease and desist. And it's like, wait, what? I don't, like, nothing would be in my way from providing this service. And this is still a trusted custodial service. But just that difference from setting up some sort of a mint or payment system or little business for not needing 100,000 customers to start out to even begin to be sustainable, but for two people, where we can just try it out and it works. It works, and I could send it to literally anybody on Nostr. Just that element of permissionlessness, the fact that anybody can build, anybody can plug in, and anybody can provide a service, in comparison to literally everything in the global fiat system. That alone, even if all it did was mean that we could only use centralized trusted services, but simply that was the change, the dynamic of the change when it comes to who can offer that service and how difficult it is to offer that service. That singular change is world shattering. I would liken it to, if I wanted an analogy to try to get someone a picture to think about how big of a deal it is that it's a little bit like being able to go from a analog ISP to a digital ISP. Now, what do I mean by that? So the internet, your internet service provider, like, literally has to run lines to your house, right? Like, there's lines on the road. And in fact, a lot of the same companies end up having to rent space like rent bandwidth on those lines just to offer you the service, which means that it's like a permissioned network where they're actually sharing the available bandwidth on the one physical line, or maybe two if you're lucky, that connect to your house, which means that your options are the three companies sharing the coax or the one company that owns the fiber, which is really just two options. Now imagine if you don't actually need any physical relationship whatsoever. There's nothing in the real world that you actually have to connect. You can have a digital one, and literally anybody who can just write a piece of software, and that you're just like connected to this. You can like me right here in North Carolina, by just like pasting an address, like an internet address into my modem, I could have my internet service provider be some random dude running it for 10 people in Shenzhen, China. And even crazier is I was connected to the broader internet. I could just connect to all the internet. Like, that was it. I could just use, it just didn't matter where I was. I could pick one in Russia. I could pick one in India. I could pick one in Brazil. I could pick one in Europe. Doesn't matter. Any ISP in the world is now on the table for me. My selection just went from two different companies pretending to be four different companies to literally all internet companies, all of them, anywhere in the world. And because of this joint net internet, because there's this ethereal network that somehow connects us all, I have access to all the internet services. This is what we're talking about when it comes to eCash and having like a mint, having a pure software version of a payment system that you can use by or for anyone anywhere in the world. And then because of the Lightning Network, because of the instant payment and the settlement, the ability to pay a Lightning invoice, I'm immediately connected to everyone. I can send my one dude in Shenzhen, China, eCash sats to you on Noster, and you just receive sats. You don't even have to know what I'm using. And this is specifically because the you need a central bank account permissioned level has been replaced with Bitcoin, and the you need Fedwire and ACH and Visa compatibility in order to make payments has been replaced with a decentralized permissionless Lightning. Like, as a structure, just as a system, this is 10 to 100 times better than the fiat system. As a network, it is still small, but it is going to be so much more valuable than the fiat system it is replacing, because it's literally going to be like comparing the internet to broadcast media, to like the three main channels that everybody got and the opinions that were shared on them, versus what can you do, who can you talk to, what can you access, how can you reach people, how can you build networks and communities on the internet, versus what do you have limited when you have radio and broadcast TV. Obviously, if you were just adding up the media that existed before the internet, and then you compare it to the internet is 10 to 100 times more valuable because of just the structure of it, let alone the fact that the network is going to be orders of magnitude larger as a consequence of it. And specifically in my thinking of, you know, the evolution of these things always seems to be a two steps forward, one step back sort of thing, where we create this, you know, most things exist in the realm of creating some sort of service or like kind of mental model for how things should work, but then they're implemented manually, right? They're implemented in some analog sense. And then we figure out how to automate or create a protocol for one of those core functions. And it kind of moves into this new era. Now we have this one step back at the layer above, because it doesn't fundamentally solve the problem. It's all just a trajectory, right? It's just a spectrum of moving in one direction. But I think we're consistently moving toward building structures that stand on their own and people participate within them. Like, and the incentives are set up because, simply because of survival. I don't think this is like, oh, technology is ultimately freedom and decentralizing. I think it's just that decentralization and freedom are the only thing that actually have the adaptive nature to overcome a changing environment. You have to evolve. If you're not in line with the natural incentives and flow of evolution, you're just going to run into a wall at some point. Like, centralization is fragility. It works to spread out the access to the solution to a problem, but it becomes incredibly brittle. It's hard, like ceramic, like it's a very, very hard thing, but it's also very, very brittle. So it works right up until it breaks apart. And I believe anything that attempts to create incentives in which some group of people, where the larger group of people work inside of the incentive structure, but another group of people work outside and enforce the incentive structure, you can't have people, it's like having your referees also be part of the game. So, you know, if your referees, like, and you can't escape that. If the system is run by people, then necessarily the referees are part of the game. Because the game of society must encompass everyone. There's nobody who can just, like, be outside of society. So we set these governance systems up as if those people are separate. And then we even have this, like, weird mythology that they're public servants and they have no ill intent and they couldn't possibly want things. They couldn't ever be selfish or biased, which is so stupid. It's the most, like, it only makes sense to teach that to people in kindergarten through fourth grade, because that's the only time that you're stupid enough to really buy it. When you actually grow up and you realize that basically everybody lies and everybody twists things to their perspective or what benefits them, like, it's just kind of like a natural thing. You couldn't get somebody who's in their late 20s or 30s to really swallow that. That's a very, very difficult thing. But if you teach them that when they're in second, third, and fourth grade, and then they just grow up believing it, they forget to question it. It never just comes into their realm of, like, oh, I should reassess this idea. And often their worldview and emotional state becomes so invested in that idea that they build up this wall, and they just get angry when you even, like, put, it's so uncomfortable to even begin to realize that you've been wrong about that your whole life. So when you have humans running the system also necessarily being part of the outcome of that system, there's no way to have impartiality. There's no, absolutely no way, if the rules themselves become subjective to the interpretation of the quote unquote enforcer, and the enforcer themselves can profit from that, the entire thing is doomed. It's just a matter of time. If the referees are in the actual football game, and they can earn points, and the referees are able to just hand out points, the referees are going to end up winning the game. And that's just how it's going to be. And everybody's going to end up, the game is going to be completely, is going to devolve from actually trying to produce good football, or whatever the sport is, rather than be good at the sport, it's going to devolve into a system, into a game of pampering the referees. How do you cozy up? How do you become friends with the people who just arbitrarily hand out points? And so as I see it, what happens is the market attempts to find centralized solutions. It tries to build solutions to problems and offer them as a service. But when those problems are cooperation problems and organization problems between people, eventually those things shift towards protocols. Because those are the only real solutions to those problems, because the centralized service provided solutions always turn to giant, centralized, very brittle, and very corruptible entities. And it's not even a matter of, like, freedom is better than communism or morally superior. It's a matter of survivability. The internal incentives of the system have to be aligned with the external reality. And as soon as you introduce corruption or the ability to corrupt it, then that alignment disappears and reality will eventually just come through in a giant avalanche and destroy everything. And we'll be like, oh, well, I thought we were playing the game really, really good. Yeah, well, your game was horribly designed. It had nothing to do with the reality of the situation. So the point of that tangent was to bring up the fact that one of the big things that we've seen in the Web 2.0 era is the rewalling of the platforms, the the walled gardens of the Apple Store and the Google Play Store and the walled gardens of Twitter and Facebook, all these networks with these massive network effects where the value of them is literally in the people that are on them. So it's like we're literally giving the network all of its value, and then the people who control the network are literally using it against us to trap us. Like we're the ones giving them all of the strength and momentum in order to prevent us from having an alternative. And this is exactly why networks, organizations, rules must be, eventually, we must figure out how to make them protocols. But there's even like layers of technology that has to happen for making a certain thing a protocol to even make sense. Like you first had to build the internet and make basic communication and media and, you know, building communities and all of these things, you had to shift these over into the digital world in order for the idea of a digital protocol for monetary organization, for economic organization, to actually make sense. Because if you're trading, your exchange, your communities, and your communication isn't digital, isn't on the internet, then having a digital money doesn't mean anything because you don't have the infrastructure to actually do anything with it. So a lot of these are actually path dependent on the previous major leap in infrastructure and creating a protocol for the other thing. This is why I think ultimately all governance that can be made into a protocol will be made into a protocol. But what we have thought of as like the government, this one thing that does, quote unquote, this one thing, is actually like 50 different layers all doing 50 different things. And I think the only way we literally have to break them out one piece at a time, one layer at a time, and actually create them in a digital system, in a system where there are actually rules, and we simply participate in those rules because those rules they produce the better outcomes. And Bitcoin is the monetary layer that allows the financial layer, the settlement layer, the payments layer, and the consumer and retail, like multiple layers on top of it, is exactly what allows that to enter into an entirely different paradigm of how we build it, how we think about it, where the center of control is. And going back to the idea of these things like being walled gardens with Web 2.0 and stuff, this is the most powerful thing, I think, when I'm trying to imagine, okay, what's the next great one step back going to be? And everybody's always like, oh, we're just going to be Web 2 again, and it'll be Bitcoin Web 2. We have to remember that Web 2 was not what happened with broadcast media. You can't apply you can't just like take the old model and then like stick it onto the new thing. It's going to look different because the dynamics are different. And the powerful thing about Lightning is that if things like eCash and stablecoins arise, but they end up being settled over Lightning, that element of everybody's on Twitter because everybody's on Twitter doesn't exist. It's everybody is using an eCash or a stablecoin because everyone's on Lightning. Lightning is the universal language, and the network of one eCash versus another, you're purely in the market for trust. It's that one eCash might be more trusted than another. But there's no, because, you know, 100,000 people or a million people are using this particular stablecoin, then I have to use this stablecoin because otherwise I cannot communicate with those people. That dynamic of Web 2.0, of the walled garden social medias and the app stores, doesn't exist where we're going. It does exist right now because of the way development has gone so far. In fact, you could argue that the current state that we are in is a one step back. Tether is a one step back in the sense that we've created a new, it's two steps forward because it's a huge improvement to the fiat fractional reserve system. It's a huge improvement to the infrastructural access and the fact that you have a permissioned system, and now Tether is basically not permissioned when it comes to just like a basic, like setting up a wallet and receiving Tether. It's a vastly more open and accessible system, and it's a vastly improved system over the fractional reserve system, but it does have that Web 2.0 network consolidation effect, is that Because other people are using Tether, you have to accept Tether in order to accept USD stablecoin. And if you're using USDC or USD Guy, you know, whatever, some other random thing, well, you can't get your US Guy wallet out and accept Tether. They are literally walled gardens, and it doesn't make sense. The way these things need to should be built out is exactly how they're headed that way, and or exactly the direction that they are inevitably headed. And that's why I think Alan Farrington's piece that we just covered is such a potent example of showing why I think the incentives are just going to go that way. And I think this transitional phase is actually going to be kind of a short little burst. Like, this is a small stepping stone to figuring out, like, it is actually recreating the Web 2.0 problem, but I think it's a very small stepping stone, because we're essentially stretching out the entire history of and mistakes of the web itself onto Bitcoin. But I think we're accelerating it because it's just a new paradigm. The thing that we've invented, the thing Bitcoin itself, is so foundational that it's just going to develop its own protocol stack, because it is the TCP/IP of money. And I don't mean that, it's almost hard to even call that an analogy, because it just is. It's the foundation of the monetary stack. You have the internet and the communication stack, and now we have the monetary stack. And so it's going to kind of go through a bit of a mirror. Like, we're going through the spam period, we're going through the how do we deal with this, we're going through the Lightning, like the first protocol for payments on top of it, and international settlement. We're going through the Web 2.0, is it okay, we're creating centralized networks on top of it, like stablecoins that actually have a legitimate use case and they have product market fit. And so what are the fallbacks of those things? But I think we respond and adapt to those things way, way faster, because we kind of have corollaries. We see them coming. They've been discussed even ahead of time. And in addition, any solution that we have for the Web 2.0 problem, which I think is better funded and more obvious, and the pressure is larger than it has ever been to solve those problems, essentially the same type of architecture can immediately be applied to the Bitcoin, the payments, the stablecoins, and eCash, like to that whole model, to solve the problem on the Bitcoin stack. In fact, they might kind of get solved at the exact same time, because you have this parallel protocol stack that's going through the exact same problems, and they're at the beginning rather than the exact same problems of Web 2.0, where they're at the end of their cycle, I think, or they're at least tipping over the hill and starting to go downhill, because I think the momentum is larger than, and like I said, momentum and pressure is larger than it's ever been to actually solve these problems. And we're making a whole loop all the way back around to eCash, created in the freaking early 90s. And now it actually has an independent digital settlement network and monetary network to be sustainable, to suddenly be a product, and not a product that, like, just DigiCash owns and tries to license out to all the big computer companies and all the big software companies, but an open source and freely available software that literally anybody in the world can create a mint for. And it's all interoperable, and there's no, like, walled garden network effect because of the Lightning Network being the universal language and the only thing that it makes sense. Your eCash is dead in the water if you can't pay a Lightning invoice, because Lightning is already the foundation for how to send an instant payment. Like, Marty Bent is 100% right. The cypherpunk banking stack is coming, and something we have already seen that I think is so powerful when it comes to the model of solving the financial system, the massive misalignments of the financial system, is the fact that loans, general finance, like the financialization and creation of derivatives and contracts and all of those things, and banking and general payments and banking are all going to be totally separate services. They already are. Like Unchained and Ledin and these, the lending on-ramp, or wait, does on-ramp do lending? I don't think they do. On-ramp is just like a multi-sig thing. But all of these things are their own services. Like they have their own model. They have their own business model. They have a very strict and simple setup. And they're not providing debit cards. They don't need any of that, because they're just loan services. And then basic retail payments and consumer payments are done on top of Lightning and with stablecoins. And those stablecoins, because they don't do anything else, because they're not using customer balances to leverage up and lend out a whole bunch of money that doesn't exist in some weird amorphous blob of all financial and banking things into this one big bloated apparatus where they can create money and they can fulfill payments and they got debit cards and loans and fractional reserve everything and they make derivatives. Like, it's all just been mushed together. It's this whole, it's very much in line with why, like, all of our financial instruments are now collateral for all of the clearing banks, is because the only way to actually deal with the insolvency and the massive leveraging of the system is to lower the leverage by roping in some other part of it. It's just like all the other corporations and stuff, as they get bigger and bigger and they get more and more financing at impossible rates that are just because of the money printer. Well, after they already have a massive amount of the market, what do? Well, they go vertical. They just take the market underneath them and the market above them, and they dominate the production market, and they dominate the resource mining market, and they dominate the retail, and they just go the whole stack up and down so that they become larger and even more consolidated, which actually makes them worse. It actually, like, internally it's more efficient, but externally it's way less robust, it's way less adaptive, and it causes more problems. But that's what you do when you have unlimited financing and you don't have any, there's no new ideas, you just get infinite resources because you're big. Well, the same thing has happened. We've already watched all of the same things happen in finance, is that you have to go vertical. Okay, well, since we're super leveraged and we're all going to implode just because of our financial instruments, well, let's take in, you know, traditional retail banking. Let's take in normal people's bank accounts, and now that's collateral. And let's make all of their payments, all their normal retail payments, that's collateral, and all of their retirements, that's collateral. Let's rope it all in, because the more we can get in here, well, then the less our current leverage is bad, but we're still going to engage in all the exact same behaviors, and now we can just add a zero on it, and we can make our leverage even worse and even bigger, and we're all tied to this giant ship that is inevitably going to all explode, and people don't even know it, because we've just made the financial system this one big giant insolvent, highly leveraged blob. We're already separating that out. We're already piecing out the things that matter and making the service that does the loans and the service that just does fully backed retail payments. And that's exactly what eCash is. Imagine how much easier the trust profile is of eCash when you're talking about one service provider just needing one explicit amount of Bitcoin to back the explicit amount of eCash tokens that it has offered. And that's it. That's the whole risk profile or trust profile of an eCash mint. Right now, when you get that with a banking service, you're tied to like 100 other things that you don't even understand, that most people couldn't even explain it to them to understand how it works. And they have no idea. They don't even know that their retirement is stuck to that exact same, it's attached to their own balance in the bank account. And that if you had to run on normal retail bank accounts, you could have the financial, the clearing party between banks go under as an insolvency issue or a counterparty insolvency risk with the bank that they're clearing payments for. They're insolvent and leveraged, and so they take all of the assets of that company as collateral, and your retirement just happens to be in there too. And you didn't even know. What do you mean, my custodian for all the equity I own went under because of a bunch of startups taking money out of the bank account of Silvergate or whatever bank? What do you mean? That doesn't make any sense. We're separating out those jobs. We're separating out the roles. We're separating out, we're granularizing the trust problem into their own little pockets, so they're easy to understand. They do one job, and I think those are the things that will survive, because that specialization survives. Adaptability survives. If you have 10 different pieces of a workflow all stuck together in the same company, in the same mindset, in the same culture, and under the same financial situation, well, it's just less likely to survive. Sure, it might be more efficient in the short to medium term, but in the long term, what if one of those has a fundamental change in how the technology and how the thinking around it work? Just like, you know, part 9 of the stack in, you know, 1 through 8 stay the same, 10 stay the same, and that the model, the mental model and the culture would still work with those. But 9 makes some sort of a fundamental change. Well, if They don't either let go of it or change their mental model, which, because of the other nine, they're way less likely to do so, then eventually that piece of it is going to break and there's going to continually be more and more problems because guess what? Not everything adapts at the same time, and almost invariably the people who succeeded in the old model and who succeeded in the old way of thinking about things suck the most at the new way of dealing with it because they've built those pathways in their brain and they're less likely to be. This is exactly why you have the old and the new. This is exactly why you'll never get around the fact that you need young people, you need the cycle of life, and you need old people to die off because they succeeded in a way that the world used to be, and you need young people building new pathways and new ways of thinking about things that take advantage of the value of tradition and the old structure while being able to evolve, while being able to actually adapt quicker and with more excitement and more energy to all of the new things that are happening and the new models that are being built, because technology changes so fast and it's just getting faster. And because we have become a society, because we are no longer just individuals by ourselves in the woods, even families just out in the woods on our own in small tribes, because we become this massive society, our technology is our environment now. This is why the forever pessimist, they just piss me off. It's like, how can you be defeatist now? Like, you're just never going to win anything. You're never going to actually accomplish anything if all you do is just, sure, point out it's fine to talk about the things that aren't perfect. That's a super critical part of the process. But to just be everybody took it over, like to completely miss the forest for the trees because of the huge foundational shifts, because you can point at somebody who's an asshole somewhere. Guess what? They're always going to be here. Guess what? We're always never going to completely solve any problem. The idea that there would just be this full-on, complete totality of a solution is absurd. Everything is a trade-off. Everything is a trade-off, and we're making leaps into the realm of ease and the realm of comfort and the realm of alignment that our next trade-off is. Like, huge leaps forward, and there are so many options to explore, and so, like, people are literally throwing their hands up because it's like, oh, politics still sucks. It's like, no shit, it's politics. If that's all you focus on or care about before Bitcoin, you're going to be depressed. And if that's all you focus on and care about after Bitcoin, you're still going to be depressed because politics isn't going to change. Focus on solutions one step forward at a time. Quit looking for the everything app that's going to solve the whole world's problems because it doesn't exist. And quit identifying with the problem. If every single thing we invent or create or build is just identified as the sum of everything it doesn't fix, then in that mind, there's literally no possible way to have progress. Because inevitably, everything will not fix more than it fixes. A little bit of perspective and putting the comparison in the right place goes a really, really long way. But anyway, I'll be done with my rant today. I think I'm going to try to have Callie on the show because I really want to talk about eCash and get his thoughts on a lot of these different things. And the really cool stuff, Callie has just been just charging forward on this, you know, like it's always so crazy to see how few people work on things that I genuinely think are going to be foundational. And then they'll probably hit this point where something just clicks, something just works, or something is just integrated in a certain way. And then the flood comes. And I think it's going to be really interesting because I think eCash is getting close to that point. And if you want to hear more about it, you better subscribe to Bitcoin Audible because this is where you'll learn all about it. I've also got a couple of really good guys' takes coming up. I've got another one on deflation because holy crap, I just read a couple of posts that oh my God, I cannot believe how prevalent this ridiculous notion is. But I think I've actually figured out a different way to explain it that I think just shows another layer of how absurd the whole deflationary hoarding spiral really is. So we'll have that pretty soon. I'm trying to get all my thoughts together on it. And then also I've been digging into the CTV plus CSFS soft fork proposal. I feel like there is more consensus on that as a major and really important improvement that also has the least, like, just such a small profile as to what the potential risks of it could be. And they're also just very basic opcodes, which that alone just has so, like, it doesn't, it changes so almost nothing about how signatures are interpreted, how you could, you know, insert data into the chain. Like, it's just so minimal. I feel like this is like, and I don't think it's in any rush. I still think, you know, even if this happens in 5 years, I think we're perfectly fine. So far, everything that I've dug into it, I really like the primitives that these two tools allow. The one I know less about is CSFS, but the more I learn about it, the more it seems to make sense. But regardless, I'm still digging into it, and, you know, I haven't made a full conclusion on it. It just, in right now, it seems like the way to go in my where my current thinking on it is. But I'm still digging a lot into it, and I'm also happy for, in fact, I really would appreciate people who are against CSFS or CTV. Less on CTV, just because I feel like I've read almost everything against it already. I've done a couple of serious deep dives if you've listened to those in the past. But I'm more interested in CSFS because I don't want to just go down the, like, everybody who really likes CSFS is explaining it and all of its benefits and here's no drawbacks whatsoever. I want the full story. That's the whole point of this show. That's the point of my exploration of it and then trying to explain it to you guys. So let me know. We'll have a guy's take on that one coming soon. But with that, a final shout out to Marty Bent, a shout out to the HRF and the Financial Freedom Report, and to PubKey, re-decentralizing the model of the web itself. Some really exciting things coming there. So stay tuned. And until next time, everybody, that's my two sats. A goal is not always meant to be reached. It often serves simply as something to aim at. Bruce Lee.